case for argument is Blue against the Hartford Life and Accident Insurance Company. Mr. Jardine.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. I please the Court. My name is Dan Jardine. I represent William Blue, the appellant in this case. As you will have noted from the brief, Mr. Blue was an individual who was on disability beginning in 1998 with respect to a condition that's difficult to describe, so I'll just say it once and then hopefully be done with it. Spinopalatine ganglion neuralgia. And he was covered and received benefits from the appellee, Hartford, for roughly a decade. In 2008, he was denied further benefits because of what Hartford contended was his failure to meet the definition of disability under the, quote, own occupation, end quote, standard. Mr. Blue asked for a copy of his policy, received the same own occupation policy. Based on the facts of the case, which I'll get to in a second, he filed a suit in Wisconsin court, and it was removed to federal court. At no time up to that point had Hartford ever indicated that Mr. Blue's disability claim was being analyzed under anything other than the own occupation standard. The issue was joined in September and of 2010. In November, there were Rule 26 initial disclosures made. At that time, there was a 1,300-page claim file produced. No indication from Hartford or its counsel that there was anything in there other than the same policy that had been produced to Mr. Blue previously. It's worth noting that the court might wonder, with initial disclosures being exchanged in November, summary judgment being already at the end of January. In this particular case, we were perfectly content to make our argument on whether there was a breach of contract by virtue of the claim file. From at least my perspective, no need to engage in discovery on that particular topic. With respect to the bad faith claim, we expected that there would be a motion forthcoming on that. Once again, we would fight it out based upon what was in the record in the claim file. A bit fortuitously, actually, when I was preparing the motion for summary judgment in early February, I wanted to use the copy that was in the claim file as opposed to having Mr. Blue have to sign an affidavit about here's a copy of the policy that I received. In looking at that policy, which looks identical to the policy produced to Mr. Blue, I noticed the difference in the language. So the summary judgment motion that I filed was based upon the any occupation standard. I'm sorry, I used the wrong term before. He was given the policy that showed that he was disabled only if he was disabled from any occupation. In fact, he had an own occupation policy. I cited that language and filed the motion. Up to this point, the only extension that Mr. Blue had asked for was for a week for extraordinary circumstances that were set forth in my affidavit in early February. Indeed, that affidavit got submitted with all sorts of courts. It was basically my return to the office after some significant problems. The court granted it. There was no issue, no delay. Only after receiving my motion did Hartford indicate, wait a minute, we would like an extension to look into this matter. We stipulated to it.
We've reviewed all the briefs. I want to kind of skip the scenario to get to extension five, because the standard we have to apply is abuse of discretion. And so, you know, the question has to do with, you know, due diligence and, you know, how we got there and this request in the final 2 weeks.
Indeed. In fact, we fully recognize the importance of a court needing to control its calendar. In the cases that have been cited in both briefs, the delays that were caused by the party seeking extension of time were far more egregious than in this case. Up to the time that we asked for an extension of time to file a motion for the new summary judgment motion that had been filed by Hartford, the only request that we had asked for was the one-week request in early February. It didn't forestall the trial at all. It didn't inhibit the ability of the case to proceed
and
to trial.
Was that the request where you wanted six company officers produced within a certain period, within a week?
No. What I'm talking about in early February was that was our initial deadline to file motions for summary judgment. I asked for that extension. After that, Mr. Blue and I had not asked for any extensions. It was the Hartford that had asked for the extensions. After we filed our motion for summary judgment, it asked for 3 weeks' worth of time to simply look into the matter. When it did, it asked for an additional 3 weeks of time to file a new motion for summary judgment, or rather a new brief based on new grounds, and asked for the trial to get bumped. Mr. Blue had nothing to do with this. We didn't need a day. We didn't want a day to file our response to the motion for partial summary judgment filed by Hartford based upon its analysis of Mr. Blue's claim using the any occupation standard. Didn't need any extension at all. Hartford was the one asking for what turned out to be a month and a half extension. It filed its new motion on the new grounds, the honest mistake grounds, on April 18. I contacted Hartford's counsel on April 22, saying I'd like to take some discovery on this. Can we talk about a date? No, put it in a notice of deposition. So I did. Heard no response, so I sent emails, made phone calls, and then finally in response, I received an email from Hartford's counsel indicating we're not going to allow or at least concede to an extension of your time to file a response brief, and provides no dates. I continually asked him, well, how about a date? He asked for the notices. He made the objections, never providing a date. When I finally got one, it was scheduled for May 19. My intent was on May 9 to file a motion with the court saying, fine, we finally have a date. Can I please take the deposition and then file my brief at that time? For reasons that are explained in the record, I had an emergency issue going into the hospital. Filed that motion for an extension of time 2 days later on the new deadline established by the court. So at this point, Mr. Blue has not caused any delay of any sort. The only thing that there was, if you want to consider there being some delay on, was the time between April 18 and April 22 to ask for the deposition of Mr. Zlutty and Davis. It is, again, I recognize the court's need to manage its calendar. But up until this point, Mr. Blue has not been engaged in any dilatory conduct at all.
Counsel, you're arguing as if we were making this decision. Mm-hmm. Our review is deferential. You need to engage the standard of review.
Indeed. There is broad discretion given to the trial court to manage its calendars. But, however, in the let's look at the Spears case, which is the one that is relied upon primarily by Hartford. I have no problem with this case at all. In the Spears case, the trial court had given the plaintiff, in its words, more than enough time and several extensions. And indeed, it makes reference to the first request for an extension, similar to ours, for a short period of time to file a brief. The court says certainly nothing particularly unusual about that. In Spears, the plaintiff asked for 42 additional days to file a brief, 57 days after the time that the other party had filed a motion for summary judgment. As I indicated before, we didn't need a day, didn't want a day, to talk about Hartford's analysis under the any occupation standard. As a consequence, for the reasons stated in Schilling and in Weber, a case should not be dismissed, which is essentially what happened here, when the court denied our opportunity to file a response brief of any kind. We lost the opportunity to not only to respond to the new argument about honest mistake, we lost the opportunity to respond to our primary argument, that even when Hartford was analyzing Mr. Blue's case under the wrong standard, it exercised bad faith. We didn't need any extension of time for that at all, and we lost that opportunity. As indicated by the Schilling Court and Weber Court, that the effect of this type of sanction should be done only when there is egregious conduct. Here, to the extent there was dilatory conduct, it was on the part of Hartford. I fully acknowledge that we had what turned out to be a 10-day delay at the beginning of the summary judgment briefing schedule when we filed our first motion. But after that, the delay was at the request of Hartford, not us. So as a consequence, Mr. Blue, it's true that in addressing the standard issue, I believe what it comes down to is there are two interests here that are both quite important. One, the ability of the trial court to manage its own calendar. Second, however, is the right for a person to have their day in court. As indicated before, in this particular case, Mr. Blue lost his opportunity to file information or to a brief on the issue that he was fully prepared to brief back in February. The court didn't indicate in its order of May 19, literally minutes after we had finished the depositions that we had asked for. The court didn't say at any point from our request to its order, no, I'm not going to give you the extension, file what you have. It gave us no opportunity to be heard at all. In our opinion, that is far too egregious of a sanction, if a sanction is owed at all. Keep in mind the delay in getting the deposition. When we asked for it on April 22, the deadline was still 2.5 weeks away. There's really only two witnesses I wanted to take. We took them by phone. It's not unusual to be able to get a deposition taken in 2.5 weeks. However, I didn't even get a date to potentially take depositions until close to the deadline. So as a consequence, to the extent there's delaying conduct here, it's not Mr. Blue's. And if it is, it's so slight, it should not result in essentially dismissal. Now, we filed a Rule 59e motion for to amend the judgment to give the opportunity to the court to correct what we believe was a serious error, and we submitted evidence to show that, no, the, quote, undisputed evidence based upon Hartford's brief is, in fact, disputed. There was the affidavit of Maureen Van Dinter, which had actually been previously filed with our initial motion, indicating that she had consistently told Hartford that the reason Mr. Blue was disabled was not because he couldn't do sedentary work, It was because he couldn't work a normal schedule. Hartford's own people, early on in 2002, agreed that his ability to not work a schedule was what made him disabled, even under the any occupation standard. Again, Hartford continuously states that Blue argues for the first time that they used the wrong policy and wrong standard. I'd like the court to keep in mind, this information was not available to Mr. Blue until it was given to him in the lengthy claim file. Hartford had at least as much of opportunity to know what the correct policy was. Its counsel in producing the documents had as much ability to tell what the policy said. I believe it's fair for Mr. Blue, and more particularly me, to rely on the fact that they had already produced the policy, and of the 1,300 pages I need to read, I can concentrate on the new stuff, not the stuff I've already read. So as a consequence, I believe that there's it's not just an exercise to establish that there was a breach of or abuse of discretion. There's also evidence in the record to show a reasonable juror that Hartford did not have a reasonable basis for denying the benefits, didn't even use its own standards that it had previously, and that the fact that they were ignoring their very own standards previously was a reckless disregard of his rights. And as a consequence, we ask the court to reverse the decision of the trial court.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Tostrud.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Interviewing a district court's discovery and scheduling and case management orders for abuse of discretion, this court has repeatedly emphasized the need to take a look at the totality of the circumstances, or at least I should be precise about that. Need to respect the district court's firsthand look at the totality of the circumstances. And here, I think that's an important aspect with respect to this appeal. It is reasonable to ask, if you focus on one isolated request for an extension of time to take depositions, that at least on the surface would be for some period of roughly 2 weeks, to suggest that that is a reasonable request. And I understand that. But to look at just that request in isolation would ignore the totality of the circumstances. First of all, to that point, as we point out in our brief, there had been no discovery. That is not due diligence that then serves as a prerequisite to good cause. Second, I think this is important to point out with respect to this appeal itself, what evidence is cited in Mr. Blue's appellate brief here before this court consists in the main of evidence that he had all along because it comes from the claim file. In addition, he cites to Mr. Davis, who was disclosed as part of our Rule 26 disclosures in November of 2010. That is information that he had all along. It is true that Mr. Luddy's identity was not disclosed until March, but it is also true that no deposition or other discovery was sought from Mr. Luddy or requested from Mr. Luddy until over a month later. I tread cautiously, but firmly here. That is not an exercise of due diligence that justifies abuse of, or justifies reversal of a district court's case management order for abuse of discretion. I think it's also fair to say that the totality of the circumstances here engendered some skepticism on the part of the district court, reasonably so. The frequency of the extensions, Your Honor pointed out that we're talking really about extension 5 here. That is correct. There were 5. The manner in which they were sought, last minute or frankly not at all, twice things were filed after the deadline, and the district court tacitly accepted those filings. Finally, the varying rationales all serve to undermine the validity and the credibility of those requests for extensions. This case is, in fact, just like Spears, remarkably so. The number of requests for extensions is virtually identical. The grounds for those requests for extensions are identical, or very similar, I should say. The fact that the district court in Spears had approved of 2 or 3, and I apologize, I don't remember precisely which, but 2 or 3 of those requests for extension before finally having had enough and denying the final request is identical. And then finally, I would point to this court's, actually, this panel's decision earlier this summer in the Justice versus Town of Cicero case. This court's made very clear under those circumstances that it will not reverse the district court for abuse of discretion under those circumstances. Finally, I think it's important to point out that Spears has one other very important similarity to this case. In Spears, as in here, the district court's summary judgment decision was rendered without considering the evidence or materials submitted by the party seeking the extension. In Spears, if that decision to deny that request is correct, as it was in Spears and as it was here, then the facts deemed admitted, or the facts are deemed admitted, and that was a correct decision by the district court in Spears and again here, and it is a decision that I do not understand Mr. Blue to challenge on this appeal. Third, here as in Spears, there is no discernible challenge to the correctness of the district court's summary judgment decision with respect to the bad faith claim. To quote from Spears, the district court's decision, by virtue of its treatment of the facts, becomes unassailable. And it is so here. Finally, I would like to make just one point with respect to the contract claim and the Rule 59e motion filed by Mr. Blue. We point out in our brief that we think that that argument with respect to something, the idea that something's left of a breach of contract claim, has been waived. And we pointed out a couple of places in the district court where we think that occurred. We neglected to mention one in our appellate brief, but it is in the materials submitted by the court. It is an exhibit to my affidavit, which was filed in the district court docket number 47. In Mr. Blue's responses to our discovery requests, our written discovery requests, regarding his contract claim, he lodged a specific objection, just as he did in Mr. Blue's deposition, and just as he filed no response in the district court to our assertion that we believe the contract claim had been rendered moot by Hartford's decision to reinstate benefits. That discovery objection couldn't be clearer. The discovery objection says that Mr. Blue points out the defendant has conceded liability on the breach of contract claim, and as a consequence, plaintiff is not responding to requests that concern that matter or that relate to that matter. Clearly, everybody had the understanding and perception in the district court, Hartford and Magistrate Judge Crocker as well, that the contract claim had been rendered moot and had been fully disposed of. I think cases like this present a challenge, both from the perspective of the district court and from the perspective of an advocate. You have to try to come up with a way of responding to concerns and issues as they surface on the fly sometimes. Mr. Blue's right. Hartford, I, or someone in my office could just as easily have caught the fact that we produced an own occupation policy in the course of discovery when we'd litigated, or rather adjudicated, the case under the any occupation policy for many years. We asked, and Mr. Blue stipulated, to more time here for the purpose of investigating that issue. And we reached a conclusion within 30 days, less than 1 month, that Mr. Blue was correct and that we were not, and we reinstated his benefits. It is not fair to say, as Mr. Blue argues here, that his claim was dismissed as a sanction. Those cases are not analogous to this. This is not a situation where a court has dismissed a claim as a sanction. He prevailed on his breach of contract claim. But the facts that establish that mistake do not create any genuine issue of fact with respect to bad faith. And I don't understand that that's something that Mr. Blue seriously contends in his brief. And for that reason, this court should affirm the district court's, both its case management order, its order denying request for extension of time, and its order entering summary judgment on behalf of Hartford. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.